And everyone, welcome to the Thursday, June 18th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we have several bills, and we're going to start with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2594. Erin, could you tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2594 requires insurer of liable party to pay actual costs of emergency response provided to private emergency responders. This measure did come to you with a due pass recommendation from your Senate Business and Transportation Committee. It did come from the House floor with 56 aye votes.
Okay, and Representative Buckley, the chief sponsor, is here to tell us about his bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. This bill was brought to me by a constituent who runs North Earth and Environmental Services, which does a variety of tasks surrounding toxic spills and other somewhat dangerous activities. And the basic problem we're trying to solve is that there's great variety in payment for those services. There are some insurance companies that will pay the same rate to a company such as his for a non-toxic spill as a toxic spill. And these things, of course, require different levels of training and equipment. So what the bill does, it asks to put into statute that the services provided by a company will be paid for at the rate of the cost of those services. And the question came up in the Senate Buyers Committee about, well, how is that determined? And the answer for those rates is they're established by DEQ every fiscal year. I'm sorry, I didn't bring the website printed out for you, but I can get the website to your committee so you can see where how they set the rates for these services.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Buckley? Okay. I don't see any questions for you. We do have a couple of other people here to testify, so you might want to stay tuned.
I'll stay tuned. Madam Chair, if I can just mention, I believe that there'll be the suggestion that the bill could be amended to say something like reasonable rates. That's what we currently have. We currently have the flexibility of reasonable rates, and insurance companies will determine what they believe is reasonable. What we're asking for with the bill is to actually have the rates established that are established by DEQ be the rates paid for the services provided by the companies.
And these rates are set by the state agency.
Correct.
Right now. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We do have a few other legislators. We only have two more people on this bill, so are you all okay to wait while we hear from them? Okay. I'll call Lana Butterfield and Sean Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here on behalf of American Family Insurance Company. We are the ones who are proposing the A2 amendment. And when the bill was first heard in the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, as Representative Buckley said, there were a lot of questions. Senator Beyer had one that said, well, you know, you could charge $1,000 an hour for labor. And he had some other examples. And that turned a light bulb on in our heads. There is a standard here in Oregon that is used in many situations. In no-fault states, and in Oregon it's used in the personal injury protection statutes, and it's reasonable and necessary. So what this means from a bottom-line standpoint is that if there is a charge that seems to be excessive, then the insurance carrier is not going to just pay it. They may likely just go straight to court under the A engrossed version. Under the A2 amendment, there are other steps that can be put into place short of going to court. And if the charge seems to be excessive, and remember that the insurance company has a duty to keep rates low for its policyholders. So if it appears that the rates are excessive, then what they would do under the A2, under the reasonable and necessary, it would be incumbent upon the insurance company to prove that the rates are expensive and they would excessive, and they would do that by hiring an expert. If the hazmat cleaner didn't like what was being offered, then they would have several options short of going to court. They could, they can ask the insurer to reconsider, supply additional documentation justifying the charges, request that the insurer consider alternate dispute resolution, pursue the balance in small claims court, etc. Now, I know that the proponent of this bill is probably honest, but there are other people who are not. And this would give a more less of a cut and dried way of dealing with excessive charges short of going straight to court. And that's why we're presenting it. It has been used very successfully in paying PIP medical benefits over the years. And those statutes have been on the books as long as I've been lobbying, so, which is a long time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association. I'll be brief. We would also support the A2 amendment. I think down, if you look at lines 13 of the bill, when we're talking about the private responder reimbursement of actual costs, it's the actual word that is concerning to us. That would just change it to a reasonable and necessary. At least put some cost containment in the bill, which would improve the bill. And so, therefore, we would support the A2s and would like the committee to adopt that and move the bill forward. Thank you.
So, and I have a question, too. My understanding is that these types of cleanups are ordered by Department of Environmental Quality when there are oil spills or other kinds of hazardous situations. The previous testimony we just heard was that the rates for these cleanups are set by DEQ. So I guess I don't understand why we would need to layer an additional standard on top of rates that the agency has already set as what rates can be charged.
Madam Chair, committee members, that was the first that I had heard that answer, and I can't respond to it. But I know that there are smaller cleanups probably that aren't part of those, you know, that aren't ordered by DEQ, smaller cleanups that wouldn't necessarily be part of the toxic cleanup that is being referenced.
Madam Chair, we would argue that if that is the case, that would be reasonable and necessary. So the language that we're proposing, I think, would be reasonable at that point. And so I think what we're saying is if it's the actual cost could be different, though, and I think that's what we're concerned about.
But if the rates are set already, you wouldn't need to have a reasonable standard. You would just have to pay what the rates allow.
Yeah. And again, Madam Chair, I don't know if we have the answer, and this is the first we've discussed how those rates are set, and so I don't know the answer on every situation, every cleanup.
And my reading of this bill is that this is limited to emergency cleanups, not just any sort of somebody has something they don't like in their backyard. These are hazardous emergency situations, correct?
That's correct, from a private responder.
Okay, Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was really, Madam Chair, the same question you have, but I mean, if actual costs are the rate set by the DEQ, then I would think that rather than saying the actual costs, it would set at the rate pursuant to ORS XYZ or whatever it is. I'm struggling with now three different elements here. I mean, actual cost, in the true word of the law, means whatever it actually costs them to do it. And I think what the good representative said is there's actually a matrix and a schedule set, which would mean it would be set by some ORS standard or some OAR standard. That's what I think would be the definition of actual. But actual doesn't mean a price list set by someone else. So I'm a little confused. I have no idea, though. I'm not an expert. But, and he's not here. I thought Senator Beyer might be here to tell us what the real story was from his committee.
Senator Rosenbaum, what Senator Beyer was talking about in committee was, what if somebody decided to charge $1,000 an hour for labor? That was a concern that he raised. So I don't know if labor costs are part of what is set in the DEQ standards.
And I think maybe our committee administrator has, are you looking at the statute?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the DEQ costs charged to responsible parties for hazardous cleanup.
And does it include labor costs?
The hourly rate.
Yeah, it does actually address an hourly rate for labor of $174.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Good.
So then, Madam Chair, it should actually reference the DEQ statute of that's the rate that is allowable versus whatever actual cost means there. Because actual cost is really not actual cost. It's the rate established by DEQ, correct? I think that's where we're in agreement. Look at council. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can certainly make sure that the language is clear.
Yeah.
That's what it refers to.
I would think the courts could look at this and say actual cost is actual cost, like you and I would think. If we went to the grocery store and bought it for 25 cents, that's the actual cost versus the price that, and I'm fine with the price that they have. Just, I think this is going to open Pandora's box to something.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I don't see any for you. So thank you for your testimony. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2594. And we'll come back to this one. And what next, let's go to
2879.
Okay, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2879. And Erin, would you tell us about this?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2879 directs Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules allowing licensed pharmacists to prescribe and dispense hormonal contraceptive patches and self-administered oral hormonal contraceptives to person who is at least 18 years of age or person under 18 years of age if that person has evidence of previous prescription. It directs the Board of Pharmacy to work in consultation with the Oregon Medical Board, Oregon State Board of Nursing, and Oregon Health Authority with consideration of the Oregon Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecologist guidelines to develop standard procedures for prescribing contraceptives. Established as January 1, 2016, as operative date, there is an emergency clause on the measure. You have an A9 amendment, Madam Chair. The A9 amendment inserts women's health care practitioner as to whom pharmacists may refer patient or to advise patient to consult upon dispensing contraceptive, and it sunsets provisions relating to age limitation on prescribing and dispensing hormonal contraceptive patches and self-administered oral hormonal contraceptives on January 1, 2020. We have a minimal fiscal impact. You have a no revenue impact, Madam Chair, before you today.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I see that we have Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Bueller here. Tell us about this bill, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Senate District 17. I am very honored to sit here with my colleague from Central Oregon to support House Bill 2879, which comes to you with strong bipartisan, bicameral support. And one of the things that we know is that effective contraception is critical to women in terms of allowing them to complete their education, to delay childbearing until they've gotten all of their education, and to get into a good career so that they can be self-sufficient and move forward economically. And we know that when women succeed economically, the whole economy succeeds much better. So one of the barriers to obtaining contraception, effective contraception, is that it can be hard to get in a timely fashion to your primary care provider. And I would note that I'm fine with whatever we put in there, but women's health practitioners are primary care providers, so I'm fine with whatever language, but just to put that on the record. So getting in can be hard, especially for working women or women in school. The hours that primary care providers are available aren't always convenient for working women or women who are in the middle of college or other education. So it's very important to have them have a range of opportunities to obtain prescriptions for oral contraceptives or contraceptive patches. Oral contraceptives have been on the market for over 50 years. They have a proven track record of safety, and Representative Bueller will tell you even more about this. But there are clear data to show that it's safe for women to take a self-administered questionnaire to assess for risk factors and then have a conversation with a trained pharmacist about those risk factors to determine if she is, in fact, a good candidate for using oral contraceptives or patches, that she doesn't have risk factors that might, such as severe migraine headaches or a history of blood clots or anything like that, that would preclude her from using these medications, and that she understands how to take them properly and is likely to be compliant, because they only work well if you use them properly. And when we do that, we know that women are much more likely to be able to avoid becoming pregnant. And unintended pregnancies are really, really problematic for women and for families, because they're not ready to have kids yet. We want women to and families to be able to wait until they're really ready to be able to support a child, until they've had the education they need, mothers and fathers. And when a child comes too soon, then that's a problem. So this bill is intended to take a medication that is considered very safe, very effective for the vast majority of women of childbearing age, and make it more accessible to them in a timely fashion. And I'm going to let Representative Buehler go over all the work that he did to track down all the research on this.
Great. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And thank you, Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee for having us today. I also want to thank our bipartisan and bicameral work group, who really put a lot of effort into this piece of legislation. As you can imagine, it consisted of several of the Senate members, Senator Cruz, of course, Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Bates, and Representative Hoyle, and we worked hard to get this right. I also want to thank a lot of coalition members from the medical community, such as the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, OHSU, and the Pharmacist Societies of Oregon, along with the Oregon Nurses Association. I think the this broad group of supporters, both individually and organizational, is consistent with the broad scientific evidence that shows that over-the-counter hormonal birth control is not only safe for women, but also is be one of the most significant improvements in women's health in quite some time, maybe in decades. Studies show that having this availability of oral birth control will decrease unintended pregnancies by up to 25%. And as my senator colleague referred to, giving women more options and more control over their health care needs will make big impact, not only for health care, but also in reducing poverty. As a doctor, I believe that birth control should be as easy and accessible as possible. When I introduced this bill earlier in the session, of course, there was some hesitancy, as you can imagine. In fact, it looked like it wouldn't get going before we ever started. And I think whenever you have such an innovative idea, there's natural some hesitation and resistance to change. So we've gotten to work, and I'm proud to bring to you a bipartisan and growing coalition that also has overwhelming support in the House. There is a profound opportunity we have been given in Oregon through a unique combination of circumstances to rise above party politics and do what's right. One concern now that's been expressed recently, and it has been actually in the past also, is about the moral and ethical exemption for pharmacists. And I want to be clear, the current policy of the Oregon Board of Pharmacists allows for moral and ethical exemptions if the pharmacist can arrange for alternative means of delivering the medication to the patient. This bill does not impact anything in current board policy which, by the way, is well accepted by all, has been in place for a decade, nor will it change current best practices for pharmacists. Bottom line, the data is clear. This is consistent with what's best for women's health in the 21st century. Oregon has the opportunity to lead the rest of the nation on women's health and firmly establish a reputation as a generator of innovative ideas. This bill, combined with the recent 12-month contraceptive supply legislation, will allow Oregon women to have the easiest access to birth control in the nation, and that's certainly a worthy goal we can all be proud of. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, if I may, one other point I'd like to add. Representative Buehler alluded to the safety of oral contraceptives as an over-the-counter. We're choosing deliberately not to make this over-the-counter for two reasons. The first is that the studies that have been done have had women do this self-assessment in correspondence with, in conversation with a trained health professional, a trained pharmacist. And so we want to be consistent. We want to implement a policy that's consistent with the studies that have been done. We want to stick with the research evidence. The second is that insurance will continue to pay for contraception if it is prescribed by a licensed healthcare provider. And since pharmacists are licensed healthcare providers, and in fact we've already passed other legislation this year, 2028, which expanded opportunities for clinical pharmacists in consultation with physicians and other health providers, this is completely consistent with that. And so we want to be sure that women don't lose out on the benefits that we've had in Oregon since 2007 when we passed contraceptive equity, and that were also afforded to them under the Affordable Care Act. So women's contraceptives would still be covered by insurance under this legislation.
Okay, any questions for our colleagues? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thank you very much for all your work on this and for
thank
your
you, Madam
comments
Chair.
Today. We have two other people signed up to testify. Senator Johnson, are you okay for time if we just complete this one before we go to your bill?
Yes,
okay.
Madam Chair.
And I'll call Emily McLean and Roger Martin.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Emily McLean, and I represent Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. And I wanted to just testify briefly. We have submitted written testimony in support of House Bill 2879. Our support is also because of the Dash 9 amendments, and we just wanted to, first of all, say thank you to Representative Buehler and Senator Steiner Hayward and all the folks who came together on this bill for allowing us to give feedback and to weigh in on the conversation. As you know, as the major advocates of women's health and access to women's health, we are very supportive of expanding access to contraceptives, particularly in this way, and in the way that Senator Steiner Hayward just emphasized, which is to ensure access means also affordability and coverage in terms of insurance for contraceptives. So we are supportive and glad that the bill maintains that. We also just want to emphasize that at some point in their lives, 99% of sexually active women will use some form of birth control. So an expansion of access and ease in terms of being able to obtain contraceptives is a really big deal. And we appreciate Representative Buehler talking about the combination of the work that was done here and that the Senate supported with House Bill 3343, the 12-month dispensing of contraceptives. And we think that this is very complementary. So we just wanted to weigh in and say thank you. And we support the bill with the Dash 9 amendments.
Okay, thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair, my name is Roger Martin. This is a serious subject, but I'm tempted if you'll give me the permission to tell a little story. An older woman, somebody in my generation, had an appointment to see her doctor, and her older doctor had retired, and she had a new doctor who was up to date on all the new procedures. And he said, now, please bring with you a list of all your prescriptions, the vitamins you take, the supplements you take, and I'd like to go over them. She presented it to him, and he looked at it and said, you're on a birth control prescription. She says, yes, it helps me sleep. And he said, I'm very sorry to tell you this, but there's nothing in birth control formula that could possibly help you sleep. And she says, that's all right, young man. I grind one up every morning and put it in my 16-year-old granddaughter's orange juice, and I sleep like a log. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference, and we do have some concerns about the bill. It comes as no surprise to any of you that expanding contraception is not something the church would support. My biggest concern, and the one I want to voice, is the removal that Representative Buehler talked about of the conscience clause. And we're going to object whenever in this legislature or other legislatures the existing exception for people is removed. And I heard the word about it's still in the rules of the Board of Pharmacy. But I would just point out to you that rules are easier to repeal and change than law is. And once you get it out of the law, we're concerned the next step would be for the Board of Pharmacists to say, well, the legislature removed it from the rule, from the law. Why don't we remove it from the rules? And that's our objection. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Yes, Senator Shields has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair. I was hopeful that the Health Care Committee would have the chance to kind of wrestle with what is a pretty big policy change. I thought that after the Representative Buehler and Senator Hayward presented, there'd be some discussion about what the literature says. That since nobody else has signed up, could Representative Buehler come back? And I do have a couple of medical questions that I would love to get answered.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And Representative, I know this isn't exactly your specialty, but I know you've dug into the literature on this.
Sure. I'm guessing everybody's here because nobody else.
Some of the feedback I've got as I've floated this to primary care providers is that, hormones are pretty serious business, and that if you do it wrong, the dosage is wrong, it can have some pretty significant effects, adverse effects. Yeah. Could you talk me through kind of what if the pharmacist gets it wrong? What's the worst case scenario? And I'm also concerned that if those worst case scenarios happen, that we wouldn't even know about it.
Yeah.
There would be no way for us to assess whether or not, there were, 10 significant adverse effects, so that we would know if we need to modify this or change it in the future.
Sure. Good react? Question. For the record, Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, once again from House District 54. Good question, and certainly we don't want to do anything that's not safe. That's paramount. And the linchpin to why this is safe is that a woman will come into the pharmacy and take a 20-point questionnaire that's been well validated in the medical literature. It's reliable. A big study done in Seattle to validate how good this is. And what the science shows is that women are as good as their physicians in screening themselves for the risk and contraindications of taking the medication. And the worst thing for a woman's health is not taking one of these medications, but actually have an unintended pregnancy. The deterioration of their health from that is much worse than any potential complications from taking oral hormone birth control. So that's the reason you have national organizations such as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Medical Association, and others endorsing this kind of over-the-counter approach to oral contraceptives.
If I could follow up. I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm genuinely interested. I mean, if a woman walks into the pharmacy and the dosage is wildly wrong, that can create some problems. Can you tell me a little bit more about what those adverse effects might be?
Sure, and this doesn't preclude a woman going to her regular physician. There's a notification process built into the bill that there's already exists. Remember, one of the nice things in Oregon is that we have over a decade of experience in pharmacists prescribing medication, so we have a notification system already set up and implemented so that their primary care doctor would know they're on these medications. So if there's any complications, it would filter through that notification process.
Yeah. But to the adverse reactions, and what could happen?
The most common thing is increase in blood pressure and DVT or blood clots.
Thank you.
Remember, these medications have been on the market for over 50 years. You think about a lot of other comparable medications that have actually transitioned to over-the-counter, such as H2 blockers, which people treat for dyspepsia, or allergy medications, which a lot of people take, or even ibuprofen and Advil. They all started as prescription medications and have been moved to over-the-counter and have also very serious potential complications if taken differently.
Okay, thank you, Representative Buehler. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Burdick.
To follow up Senator Shields' questions on the side effects, for example, blood clots, a lot of that would be kind of revealed on the questionnaire, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that a risk factor type deal?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, that's part of the 20-point questionnaire, so it'd be identified. So if you have no prior history of risk of blood clots, it's really not associated with any increased risk. If you have a family history or if you've personally had blood clots, then it's a contraindication, and that comes out in the questionnaire. Remember, the questionnaire has been validated in numerous studies, including one just done up in Seattle in 2008. So women are very effective at going through that questionnaire.
And Madam Chair, if I could just follow up.
Yes,
so if you do come across a risk factor for blood clots, for example, smoking or previous history, what does the pharmacist do if that shows up on the questionnaire?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, then the prescription would not be issued and they'd be referred to their primary care doctor. If they didn't have a primary care doctor, then the way that they could get help and further medical attention with regards to that issue.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Okay, looks like you answered them all. Kay. So thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2879, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2879. And Senator Farioli.
And Madam Chair, is it your intention to move the A9 amendment?
Correct.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A9 amendment to House Bill 2879.
Okay, Senator Farioli has moved the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 2879. Any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2879 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2879 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I need to declare conflict of interest. I've had an individual family member adversely and medically impacted by wrong prescriptions of this particular type for life. Thank you. And that will be a no vote.
Okay, thank you, Senator Boquist. Any further discussion? Okay, Zoe, could you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli.
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. And motion carries. Okay, so I'll close the work session on House Bill 2879. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 963. And Erin, would you tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 963 prohibits a contractor or subcontractor or contractors or subcontractor's agent from intentionally failing to pay prevailing rate of wage, reducing rate of wage for work that is not subject to prevailing wage in order to recoup prevailing wages that contractor, subcontractor, or agent paid, withholding, deducting, or diverting employees' wages other than as provided by law, entering into agreement under terms of which employer receives less than prevailing rate of wage, for work that is subject to prevailing wage weight or otherwise permanently or indefinitely depriving employee of 25% or more prevailing wages employees do. It punishes violation by maximum of 5 years imprisonment, $125,000 fine, or both, becomes operative January 1, 2015. There is an emergency clause on the measure. It does come due with no revenue impact, and we did receive a minimal fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
And we've been joined by Senator Johnson, the chief sponsor, and thanks for waiting so patiently.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I was the instrumentality of getting this bill drafted on behalf of Hoffman Construction and the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm going to step aside and go to my own committee and allow them to make the case for the bill. But before I go, I'm going to summarize by describing Senate Bill 963 as a wage theft bill. It addresses the very serious problem of hardworking people not being paid for honest work. I urge you to hear the merits of the bill and to move forward with a work session and a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
And I am
going
to excuse myself. My committee is meeting right now.
And we'll let you go. Chair it. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Herman. I'm Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Hoffman Construction Company. I'm here testifying in support of Senate Bill 963. I'd like to thank Senator Johnson for sponsoring this and your committee for considering it. Senate Bill 963, as was stated, seeks to address an ongoing and significant issue of wage theft and prevailing wage projects. Unfortunately, there are a few bad apples out there, and they've figured out a way to develop schemes to, in effect, steal wages from their employees. Each of these schemes are relatively similar. They involve lower-tier subcontractor employers who develop these schemes to either receive kickbacks, make cash payments short of the obligated amount, or other deductions, and then falsify the certified payrolls to reflect the fact that they paid the appropriate wage. In the last 2 years, we've encountered three of these situations. They're very difficult to discover. We were fortunate. These situations involved a total amount of $350,000 that was short paid and taken, in essence, from the employees. The outrageous part about it is that these schemes generally involve preying on the most vulnerable. They make a conscious effort to hire a workforce that is vulnerable either in terms of their immigration status, their background, or their economic circumstances. And then effectively, they gain control of those folks in a way through veiled threats so they won't complain. As I say, we were very fortunate to catch it, and I can tell you that those funds have been paid to those employees. But it is an ongoing and growing problem. It will continue until there's some real deterrent in place because these schemes are very lucrative. They're very difficult to discover, which means there's a low probability that these employers are going to be caught. And the downside for them is relatively limited under the current construct under BOLI. So we think that this bill is essential to provide the kind of deterrent that is necessary to prevent these wage thefts. And these aren't honest mistakes. This is downright criminal activity. And so we think that giving the BOLI commissioner the ability to refer these types of cases to the district attorney for prosecution is essential, and I would hope that your committee would pass this bill out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council, and I would also like to thank the Senator Johnson for helping us with this, and you and your committee for hearing this today. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 963 and in support of Mr. Harmon and his idea. And first, I want to say I don't view this at all as a union versus non-union issue. It's not a labor versus contractor. It's not an anti-contractor bill or an anti-business bill. What this is designed to do, I believe, is and I've been in the construction industry basically all my working life, but I've never been a contractor. Having said that, I have all the respect in the world for contractors. They're the ones that take the risks and start a business and hire people and create jobs and make a payroll. Unfortunately, in any group or organization, there's a few bad apples, and most contractors are honest people, but this is aimed at those handful of people that, again, they're not making a bookkeeping mistake, or they're not listing an iron worker as a laborer to try and save a couple bucks an hour. These are people that are intentionally defrauding their workers, and as Mr. Harmon said, it's usually the most vulnerable ones that don't speak English, one that don't have any other place to go, don't have any job opportunity, and unfortunately they're willing to take whatever they can get. So with that, I'll close, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Just a comment. I've known people who were the victims of this type of activity, and it's reprehensible when you're dealing with someone who might literally be driven into homelessness or have their lives completely ruined simply by the fraudulent activity that you talk about. And I'm delighted to see a business and a labor representative up here testifying together on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, I do not see any, so thank you both for your testimony, and
thank
we'll
you.
Let you go. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 963, and I think this is ready to go. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 963. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 963 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 963 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And we'll ask Senator Johnson to carry her bill on the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 963. And next, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2255. Erin, tell us about this one.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2255A delays implementation of the 11-to-1 ratio of non-supervisory employees supervisory employees until June 30th of 2017. It establishes baseline ratio of non-supervisory employees to supervisory employees during the two-year delay. Requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services report quarterly on agency ratios. Specifies content of the report. It requires the department to notify labor organizations when reports are available. It provides that if agency increases its ratio of non-supervisory employees to supervisory employees during the biennium beginning July 1, 2015, increase can be credited to years after delay ends. Those provisions sunset June 30th of 2019. It requires the department to convene work group to study and report on appropriate ratios of non-supervisory employees to supervisory employees. Work group is required to report on or before start of 2017 legislative session. There is an emergency clause on the measure. This measure has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and it comes to you with 57 aye votes from your House, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And we have Barry Peck from Department of Administrative Services here. Like to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Barry Peck, Deputy Chief Operating Officer with the Department of Administrative Services. As you'll recall, in 2012, the legislature passed originally a reporting requirement on staffing ratios of supervisory to non-supervisory employees, and then later mandated a 11-to-1 ratio, with agencies making progress on an annual basis towards that 11-to-1, and if not, then there were some restrictions placed on the hiring of managers. Since that time, most agencies have made significant progress towards getting to that 11-to-1 ratio. I would say most of the large ones are at either 10-to-1 or 11-to-1 at this point in time. What we're beginning to find, though, are a number of challenges that come up with agencies, particularly in the medium to the smaller sizes, where there are distributed field offices, where you might have fewer numbers of staff, but still the need for some supervisory employees. We're finding that the exception requests are becoming more and more the norm, and more of a challenge for agencies to manage. And so essentially what we are asking for is to press the pause button at this point in time. Give us 2 years, freeze agencies where they are. No agency gets to slide back, but no agency is required to make that next step towards the 11-to-1 ratio. To give us time to convene a pretty comprehensive work group that includes agency managers, frontline employees, labor representatives, folks from the private sector, to go out and really study what best practices are based on job type. 11-to-1 is a one-size-fits-all ratio that we are finding may not be the best practice in all areas. It might work fine in an office environment, but in a 24/7 public safety environment, it presents certain challenges with childcare or direct service delivery to Oregonians. You might want a lower staffing ratio to protect health and public safety and have a better effective delivery of service. So what we're asking is, let's take 2 years. Let's go out and look at what industry best practices are by the type of work that the agencies or the business is actually in, and then we'll come back to you in 2017 with some recommendations around how to right-size this ratio to the type of work that's being required. So it's really trying to move from a one-size-fits-all approach to a more targeted, best practice-based approach in 2 years. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Do we have any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
As you studied this, what kind of range did you find? I mean, obviously, you probably found some higher ratios than required. What would be the upward level that you found?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I can tell you that within DAS, we have some areas that are 22-to-1, mm-hmm. So twice the 11-to-1 ratio. I know in some of the larger agencies, DHS, there are some that are in that same area in some divisions. What that does is it compensates for areas where it's harder to get to 9 or 10 or 11-to-1.
Okay, so follow up, Madam Chair. So the requirement then, and I'm a little rusty on what the underlying statute says, but the requirement is that the 11-to-1 has to be agency-wide, so it could in one department be considerably less?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Ferriol.
Madam Chair, I think all of us at the dais here were present in 2011, and The issue then was that there was a conclusion reached that the Oregon agencies had gotten quite top-heavy, and that when we looked into the issue, we found that there was a constant pressure to reclass, to upload the managerial staff, and based on longevity and you know, a whole bunch of pressures that agencies are under, particularly with employees that have been there a long time. You mentioned, Mr. Pack, that there'd be a pressing of the pause button and that those reclassifications would not be allowed during this moratorium. What is it that we're pausing in addition to the 11-to-1 ratio?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, the statute itself that requires the 11-to-1 ratio requires agencies to make annual progress to get to 11-to-1. If each year an agency doesn't make that progress, there is a prohibition placed on hiring supervisory positions either until the agency makes its next step or the DAS director grants an exception, and there's a series of criteria by which the director of DAS should evaluate as to whether or not to approve the exception request. The bill as amended and drafted maintains that exception process and the ban on hiring supervisory employees if the agency hasn't made its next step. It just halts that progress towards the next step for 2 years. So as an agency, if I'm at 9-to-1, and it's based on the legislatively approved budget for 15-17, so to accommodate any changes the legislature makes to an agency, we freeze there, and if I'm at 9-to-1, I stay at 9-to-1 until the 17-19 biennium when we come back to you with recommendations.
And follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
You mentioned that the exception is becoming the rule. How much is the exception process being used that would allow agencies to go ahead and move people into managerial positions even though they have not accomplished the 11-to-1 ratio?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't have stats with me off the top of my head, and it's not so much about reclassifying positions as it is hiring vacant positions where you have a certain set of criteria. So one of those that is most frequently used in my anecdotal experience, so what I've seen, I can't tell you whether it's actually the largest number, is where you have dispersed geographic offices. So you have a field office somewhere, and you've got four employees, and under the 11-to-1 requirement, if they couldn't have it, you know, not having a supervisory position out there would cause some problems, and so that's the exception request. It's not, it's very rare to have agencies entirely accept request an exception. It's more these one-offs on this program or that field office. We can't get there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry, I guess from my experience and looking out when I was with the PUC, the issue became more one of not really that people were in a managerial or supervisory position. It was the only way to get them to a salary level that allowed you to retain the talent you needed was to classify them that way, and I've seen that in a lot of different agencies. And I guess where I'm going with that is my question is how much has DAS done to look at the compensation level and classification of the employees? Because I think there's a lot of them where the skill level and stuff, you're just not going to get the employees unless you get the wage level up.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, you're right. We look at classification and salaries for represented employees every 2 years as part of the bargaining process. For management employees, we haven't done that in almost 25 years. We are in the process of doing that right now. JAS is running, we're calling it the Oregon Management Project, and that's taking a look at the classification system and moving from the principal executive manager series we have, which is this arcane A through I or J thing that really doesn't describe the kind of work you're doing, to a job family-based description of a classification that actually describes the work of the employee, so that it can actually be matched to market, because you can't find a PEMF out there in the private sector or in other state governments. You find managers of IT systems, for instance. So we are taking a look at that right now to address that very question. This bill doesn't really impact any of that because these are supervisory employees, and the question you're raising is a much broader question about management service employees, many of whom are what we call professional individual contributors. They are in management, but they don't supervise employees. The 11-1 ratio is about supervisory managers to non-supervisory employees.
Why 2-year suspension?
It's a lot of work. And when we talked about how to do this well and involve people adequately to get to a set of recommendations that we think will be a policy that we can come to you and ask for your approval of or edits to that will stand, so that we're not coming back to you every 2 years with more requests to make changes, but we'll get to something that we can move to as phase two. We would like the time to do it adequately and not rush to get to you something in February.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any additional questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2255. Open a work session on House Bill 2255. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, ma'am. Just for the record, I'll be no. It's not a reflection on Mr. Pack and his administration, but I've been here a decade. 2005 forward, we talked about this prior to Mr. Pack taking a leadership role in helping reform DAS. In 2011, we said we needed to do this, and his predecessors all dog paddled. So I'm not in favor of an extension, despite the fact he made good logic sense. So I'll just be a no vote.
Okay, thank you.
But I'm fine moving the bill, and I'm fine with him having the time.
Senator Byron, did you have a comment?
I do. I'm going to support the bill, but with reluctance. I think the 1-11 ratio and the changes that made, I remember when it was passed and I was on the other side of the table at that time, was a pain, but I thought it was a good law. I thought it was a good direction to make things happen. So I have some reluctance to do it, but given that it's just a suspension for 2 years and there's work plan in place, I will vote yes on it.
Okay, thank you, Senator Byron. I would agree that the original bill in 2011 was definitely a good move. I think what's happened is a lot of changes have been made to implement that bill, and we're now down to some situations where it's much more difficult to get to this ratio, either because of geographic far-flungness or other considerations. So I think a 2-year suspension with the intent of coming back with recommendations in the next long session is something that will make it continue but work better, hopefully. Okay, so we need to call the roll. So Zoe, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriero?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries, and I think we'll ask Senator Dembro to carry this because I believe he was the sponsor of the original bill as a representative, so he can tell us all about it. Okay, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2255. I think Senator Boquist has requested a little more time to look at House Bill 2594. And then our last bill, House Bill 2176, actually needed a technical amendment that was just discovered today. So we'll bring that back probably next week. So with nothing further to come before us today, members, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Council.
Thank you.
Council.
We're adjourned. Thank